recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Tonight, I am going to talk about Christian perspectives on immigration. I'm going to start by discussing the picture of illegal immigration in the United States, using the phrase illegal immigration to characterize the process of violating a nation's law to enter into or to stay into a country, and then using the phrase undocumented resident to talk about the people that have done that. So first I'll draw a picture of illegal immigration in the United States, talking about what the right thinks and what the left thinks. Then I'm going to talk about Christians and Christian perspective on public policy, and then move to some specific public policy issues and apply some of the themes that we've gone over to the public policy issues of the border fence between Mexico and the United States, the very strict Arizona laws that have been passed in the last couple of years, and the DREAM Act proposed legislation. All right. But first, I want to say a couple of thank yous. My name is Julia Strong. I teach political science, and this evening is the Lindemann Chair Lecture. I'd like to thank the Lindemann family. They've endowed this chair to allow faculty to work on projects over the course of a couple of years. And the projects that I've been working on last year and will be for the next 2 years are all related to faith and public policy. How do people of faith think about public policy issues? And a lot of students have been working with me on these issues, so those that have been working with me on immigration, I just want to highlight and thank for a moment. Kent Euland and Aaron Courthouse graduated last year. They worked with me on this. Breanne Reed has worked with me. And right now I'm teaching international law, and there are two students in the class that have been working on the question of whether or not the way the United States treats our undocumented residents violates our obligations under international law. So Alexander Archuleta and Sarah O'Bernier have been very helpful to me in terms of challenging my own thinking. All right? So let me start with a confession. I was an undocumented resident, an undocumented worker. And I tell you that because I think it's probably true that my department's over here going, oh, no. It's probably true that when you hear the phrase undocumented worker, you don't think about me, all right, people like me. So many years ago, I was living in another country. I had a visa, and I was having a grand old time, and I purposely overstayed my visa, and I got a job in which they paid me under the table, and I stayed in this country and supported myself with this job until I decided to leave. I didn't think about myself as being violating the law. I was just doing what I needed to do. Immigration touches my life in a couple of different ways, and I think all of us have to challenge the way we think about the words that we use to talk about this issue. I'm the daughter of an immigrant. I am married to an immigrant. So these issues are important to me, and they're interesting to me. All right, so let's start with a picture of what illegal immigration looks like in the United States. We have 317 million people living in this country. 92% of them are citizens. They've either been born in this country or they have been naturalized. So they've gone through a process and they have become U.S. citizens. 5% are residents. So I got married 28 years ago to a Canadian. And when we got married, he got a green card. And he is required by law to carry that green card around with him wherever he goes. He pays taxes. He'll be eligible for Social Security and Medicare. He is not allowed to vote, and if he breaks the law, he can be deported. Okay? And then 3% are undocumented residents, meaning that they are in the country either because they crossed the border illegally or because they overstayed a visa, like I did. 63% of them are from Mexico. This is a percentage that's been rising over the years. 15% are from Central or South America, 5% from Asia, and 15% from other countries. And I want to say just a very short thing about the open border debate. Okay, tonight we're going to put the phrase open border off the table. We're not going to talk about it. There are many good arguments about why open borders should be allowed and why they shouldn't be allowed. There are conservatives who think open borders are good for capitalism, and there are people of faith who think that open borders are absolutely required because God did not ordain the nation state. But I do not think that we're going to have open borders in my lifetime. Right now, we work under an umbrella of the sovereign nation state making decisions about citizenship. So we're going to start from that point of view as we talk about these public policy issues. I don't want to overwhelm you with a lot of graphs, but I just have a couple of pictures to help you imagine what immigration looks like. Okay, so this is immigration, illegal immigration in the United States over a course of a 10-year period. And you can see with 8.4 in the year 2000, we hit a 12 million in the year 2007. Then we see a significant dip to 11.1. And now we're at about 11.2, and that has held steady for the last 2 years. So the question is, what caused that dip? Okay, there are a bunch of different theories about what caused the dip. One theory is that we've gotten better border security, and that created the dip. The statistics do not show that we have deported enough people to achieve that kind of a dip. So I don't think that it has been better border security, although that's been a part of it. Another argument is that it's really about the economy. Many fewer people have come into this country as our economy has tanked. And particularly when you look at Mexico, the Mexican economy got better, the U.S. economy got worse, so it slowed down immigration. But that by itself is also not enough to explain this. Another thing that you have to keep in mind is the Bracero program. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. I've been practicing that word. Kim Hernandez told me how to say it, Bracero. Okay, so in just a moment, I'll explain what that is. These columns show something else that I think is really interesting. A lot of people think that there are all kinds of Mexicans coming into the United States, and for a time, that was true. But if you look at these columns, the picture is actually quite different. If you look at from 1995 to 2000, lots and lots of Mexicans came into the United States, and only 670,000 U.S. residents went into Mexico. But relatively quickly, right, from 2005 to 2010, those numbers changed dramatically, such that over the course of that five-year period, there are more U.S. citizens going to Mexico than there are Mexican citizens coming into the United States. Okay, a lot of people don't realize, but that's an important thing to keep in mind when you're talking about illegal immigration, because we want to know what causes illegal immigration and what decreases it. And then the last chart I want to show you before we get into the arguments about what people on the right think and what people on the left think is, where do people live? If you are an undocumented resident, where do you live? Now, this is an old chart from 2008, but these percentages haven't changed very much. And I think that we have to pay attention to the states where undocumented residents live so that, you know, if states are struggling or if states are having a particular kind of experience, we listen to them and we know what they have to say. So you can see a lot of undocumented residents live in California. The next biggest section lives in Texas. But then look at sort of down here on the bottom, you can see Illinois, Arizona, and New York. Okay, Arizona has gotten all the attention lately because they passed some pretty strict laws, but there's 560,000 undocumented residents in Arizona, as best we can tell. It's hard to measure. 550 in Illinois, so almost the same number in Illinois as in Arizona, and more in New York, 640,000 in New York. So I want you to keep in mind the states of Illinois and New York as we go through some more pictures later and when we talk about how states are handling the challenges of undocumented residents. So, people on the right, I'm going to first talk about the arguments of people on the right and then the arguments of people on the left as they think about illegal immigration. People on the right say three things. Illegal immigration, undocumented residents take our jobs, they cost us money, and they commit crimes. All right? Those three take our jobs, cost us money, and commit crimes. Now, I'm going to talk about each of those separately, but in order to understand the argument about jobs, you have to understand the history in the United States. So just a couple of minutes on the history of illegal immigration in our country. We did not keep statistics in this country on immigration until after the Civil War, so post-1860s. And we did not differentiate between legal and illegal immigration until the mid-1880s. In the mid-1880s, we see the first piece of legislation that is targeted toward a group, saying that this group is not invited into the country. What group do you think it is? Shout it out. It's Chinese. Okay, it's the mentally ill, prisoners, and Chinese. Okay, those three groups. Now, Canada was a very young country at this point, and it was full of immigrants, and lots of immigrants were coming from Canada to the United States. Mexico had a number of people coming from Mexico to the United States, but we appreciated the cheap labor. You can imagine in the 1880s, there were lots of ranches being developed out west. The technology of transportation is starting to be developed, and so we need a lot of cheap labor. So we don't really target our neighboring countries for quite a while. A couple decades go by. Now when you're in 1920, you start to see, because of the Industrial Revolution, a much greater irritation in the United States about immigrants of all sorts, both documented and undocumented. So in 1920, there is a quota put through by the federal government, and the quota says we are only going to take 350,000 this year. So it's an annual quota that stays stable for a couple of years, and then the anti-immigrant feeling develops more, so they lower the quota to 250,000 by the year 1925, and by the year 1927, it's 150,000 on an annual basis. So there's a lot of debate in the United States about immigration in general. Then the Depression hits. When the Depression hits, you get this huge hostility. It's not just debate anymore, but it's a huge hostility to immigrants of all sorts that are in the country. And there's a deportation effort that's put through to deport, in particular, Mexicans, primarily because they were the easiest to deport. Everybody else you'd have to put on a ship and have the ship go somewhere else, but this is a neighboring country. So during the Depression, a number of Mexicans are deported to Mexico. The Depression lasts for a period, and then World War II hits, and with World War II, the United States completely reverses its perspective on would-be immigrants from Mexico. So World War II hits, the American men and older boys go off to war, and there's a huge labor shortage. So women go into the workforce in huge numbers, but it's still not enough. They need more people, particularly men. So the United States enters into an agreement with Mexico, and they develop the Bracero program. Now, there are a lot of stipulations put on the workers, and on people that were going to be involved in this program. And you might think, well, yes, there are stipulations that the Bracero workers would come over and then they would go back after the war. But that's not what most of the regulations actually were. The regulations were put on the companies and the farms and the ranches in the United States who wanted Mexican workers. The Mexican government was reluctant to let Mexican workers come to the United States without a lot of protections. So there were a number of different protections developed that related to how much they would be paid, what kind of housing stipends they would have, where they would live, what their work environment would be like. So all during World War II, we see from World War II until the mid-1960s, okay, for a 20-year period, we see 4 million Mexican immigrants come into the United States, invited by our country to come and do some work. When World War II was over, you might think there would be a push to send these workers back home, but there wasn't, because we hit this boom. We had a baby boom. We had a housing boom. We needed more and more workers. So there was some discussion about not extending the Bracero program, but it was actually extended until the mid-1960s. Now you can imagine those families that came from Mexico to do this work in the United States by invitation of our government. They moved into communities all over. If you look at this chart, that's why we see immigrant families all over the United States. And they bought land, and they had jobs, and they had children, and their children were United States residents. So that's the backstory. Okay, now you come to this year, and you get to this argument about undocumented residents are taking our jobs. Okay, so with that background, let's talk a little bit about the argument about from the right. These pictures, I think, are important. If you look at the top left, this is a tunnel between Mexico and California, and it's filled with drugs. Okay? The top right, these, I know you can't see them very well, but just sort of use your imagination. These are the Mexican mafia in California state prisons, okay, primarily for drug running. On the bottom left is garbage. The state of Arizona says that it has 25 million pounds of garbage annually that they have to clean up related to smuggling of people over the border. And then more drugs. This is cocaine in the lower right-hand corner. So the pictures give you a sense of what people in California and Arizona in particular would say to us about the challenges that they face. So jobs, money, and crimes. Let's tease these out a little bit. When you talk about who is taking U.S. jobs, is it true that undocumented workers are taking U.S. jobs? You have to break the argument down. You cannot talk about the undocumented worker, okay, because there's all kinds of different workers. There's people who have been here for generations. There's people who have just come here recently. There's people who are here because of the drug war. There's people who are here because their families brought them. There are all kinds of different people. And there's different kinds of jobs. So the arguments about one kind of job aren't necessarily going to play for a different kind of job. So I broke this down into agriculture, trade, and entrepreneurs just to see how strong the argument really is with respect to whether or not undocumented workers take our jobs. With respect to agriculture, I could not find good studies anywhere that documented the argument that undocumented residents take our jobs with respect to agriculture. These are workers that people in the United States say that we need. And when they leave an area, when they have come to an area and they leave an area because they have felt threatened, American workers do not step in and pick up the pace. American workers let the crops rot on the trees. Okay? There was this really interesting experiment done by the United Farm Workers. It wasn't a controlled experiment. I can't say that it has a lot of academic heft to it, but it's interesting to me. They put this website up 2 years ago to say the migrant workers are not going to stay in the United States. Lots and lots of jobs have been left open. We need more workers. And they targeted college students and all kinds of other people to come and take the workers that had been left open by the migrant workers who were leaving. They had 8,000 inquiries by people, lots and lots of them college students, because it was a bad economy in the United States. So 8,000 people requested information, and only 7 went through the process to actually be hired. And when they questioned the people and they talked to them about why didn't you want this job, they were just uninterested in the job at the wages that were being paid. So when you look at agriculture, I did not find evidence that it was true that undocumented workers are taking our jobs. But it's a different story with respect to trade. Okay, when you look at trade, like the housing trade, carpenters, bricklayers, that group of people, the evidence plays out in two different ways. Middle-class America and wealthy America benefit financially from having undocumented workers. Why? Because you pay a little bit less money, sometimes quite a bit less money, and you're able to build more with workers that you're paying less. But there is a group in the United States that actually does suffer in terms of employment, and that is the low-income African-American male, right? The research that I saw demonstrates that the low-income African-American male has a much more difficult time in terms of employment when undocumented workers are present, particularly in the Southwest of the United States. So if you're interested in justice issues, that's something that we need to pay attention to. The other area is entrepreneurship, and I think a lot of people don't know this, but undocumented workers, in many cases, okay, you can't paint a brush and say everybody is in one particular way, but undocumented workers in many cases are very industrious, and all over the country, they have, especially people who came here during the Bracero program, they've started businesses and they've hired U.S. citizens in great numbers. So in terms of entrepreneurship, the evidence does not demonstrate that our jobs are being taken. It demonstrates exactly the opposite, that we are getting more jobs because of this group of people. Okay. Second area, taxes and money. Some people think undocumented workers don't pay taxes, okay? And in many cases, they don't. There are two ways, though, in which they do pay federal taxes. Social Security Administration has analyzed this and has looked at how many people there are in the United States and how many files they have and how many files they have, and they, especially since the 1940s when the Braceros were here, how many suspended files they have because they can't find the people because the people are not taking the money, largely because they don't want to be detected, right? So the Social Security Administration says that in the last couple of years, over $1 billion has been put into the Social Security coffers from undocumented workers. We say, well, how did they do that? How did they get their Social Security number? In a lot of instances, they made one up. Right, they didn't go steal identification from somebody. Long ago, there were many, many numbers that weren't taken, so they would make up a number and then pay into the system. And some of them pay federal taxes that way also. They also pay property tax on the property that they own, and they pay sales tax for everything that they buy. So if you're just looking at taxes, there's The evidence is split, but the evidence sort of weighs on the side of undocumented workers pay quite a bit into the system. However, that's not the only area in which finances become an issue. When you look at what a state pays for its residents, citizens and non-citizens alike, a state's expense for the residents comes primarily for in three categories. It is education and health and criminal monitoring. Okay, so those three things. And there are states in the United States that carry a heavier burden than others if undocumented residents are expensive. So in what way might they be expensive? Education and health particularly strong. Okay, so I think that we have to acknowledge that states like California and Arizona and Texas, along with a couple of others, are facing a challenge that a lot of other states do not face in terms of educating children, if indeed they are following through with the education that they are constitutionally required to provide for all students, whether they are citizens or residents or undocumented residents. But in the area of crimes, again, the evidence is a little bit split. If you divide out crimes into property crimes and violent crimes, okay, you get two different kinds of answers. If you look at property crimes, so theft and all the different crimes that don't really involve violence, like drunk driving, it can involve a terrible tragedy, but it doesn't necessarily involve violence. So nonviolent crimes, there is evidence that the undocumented population commits much fewer of those crimes than the regular population. Why? Because they don't want to be detected, right? But when you look at violent crimes and you break it down by state, then there is evidence that, particularly in California, Texas, and Arizona, that you see expense related to drug crimes. If you factor out drug crimes, there isn't evidence that undocumented residents cost money. If you take all of the crimes together, then it is an argument that states are making. So if you look at California, for example, the immigrant population in California, this is documented and undocumented immigrants. Immigrant population in California is 35%. The prison population of immigrants is 17%. Okay, it's quite a bit lower. Now, some prisoners will be deported, and that's why that number is going to be low, but not all of them. That's a significant difference between the immigrant population and the non-immigrant population. All right, now I want to talk about argument from people on the left. People on the left focus primarily on how the undocumented resident is treated in this country. Okay, how they're treated, what their life is like. So a couple of pictures. This is a little bit old. It's from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It's about trafficking. Okay, so a lot of people who are undocumented residents in this country have come here unwillingly. They've been trafficked from another country. 5% work in factories, 10% in agriculture, 27% in domestic servitude, but the vast majority are in prostitution. Half of them are children. Okay, that's shocking. Half of them are children. They are taken from another country, brought here for the sexual pleasure of people in this country. This estimate, 18 to 20,000, it's an estimate from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It is a low estimate, even by our government's other organizations. So other numbers that I've seen today are it's more like 40 to 50,000. Half of them are children, and most of them come from East Asia, from the Pacific. Okay, so when we talk about undocumented residents, we have to think about this population of people. These are pictures of undocumented residents from Mexico. Upper left, migrant workers. Upper right, these men were rescued in Arizona. They had been trafficked unwillingly by a man, and they were being held unwillingly in a home and rescued by authorities in Arizona. The bottom left is a young woman who was coming across the border in the desert and did not survive the journey. And on the bottom right, three children who are picking cotton here. In the United States, there are 100,000 immigrant children who pick the food for us to eat. So our food is cheap. And this is, if you were here on Monday, there was a film about this issue. That's a staggering number. It's a staggering number. So people on the left will focus our attention on the deaths of those who cross the border. Lots of them are children. Over the course of the last 12 years, 4,000 people have died crossing the border from Mexico into the United States. They'll also point us toward sex trafficking, to look at the issue of sex trafficking. 20 to 50,000 people per year, many of them children. The work of the migrant workers, how are they treated? Do they get medical care? Where do they live? What kind of homes do they live in while they are picking the food for the rest of us to eat? Is an issue that people on the left will point us toward. And then I also want to make a comment about domestic violence. If you study sexual assault and domestic violence, you'll know that 1 in 5 women in this country is a victim of some kind of sexual assault. And when you add in the numbers of domestic violence in addition to sexual assault, that number goes even higher. It's a staggering number. But if you are this pattern exists in across all ethnicities, across all economic groups, and all across the country. So if you are an undocumented person in this country and you are a victim of sexual assault or a victim of domestic violence in your own home, you will not call the police because you don't want your family to be deported. So it makes this population of people, particularly women and children, especially vulnerable. The next thing that people on the left will point to is this question of why do our southern neighbors migrate? Okay, does the United States have a role? Well, I think a lot of people would say, if you understand the Bracero program, we do have a role. We have to understand that when we invited people into this country and they worked here for us and built their families and built their lives here for us, we have some responsibility. In addition to that, there are a fair number of people who would make the argument that the United States contributed to instability in governments, particularly in Central America, and that has caused a lifestyle, a level of unrest in these countries that suggests we have an obligation to people who live in those countries as well. And then also people on the left will point to cultural capital, to the tremendous loss that occurs when you have children, particularly, who don't get the education that they need, who don't get the chance to develop their talents and become musicians and artists and business people and scientists and all kinds of other people that can contribute to the community. So arguments on the right and arguments on the left. Now, where do Christians fit into this discussion? If you look at Christian contribution to public policy debate over the course of the last 200 years in this country, what you see primarily is a lack of discussion about how Christians should engage in policy in terms of a perspective. You know, what should be the principles that guide us? What you see instead is Christians picking this policy, this policy, this policy. So we see Christians involved in civil rights in the past, in anti-abortion marches, in prohibition, all kinds of different issues that they've picked. But they can't give you a philosophy about why they pick what they pick. But there are some people who step back from this and try and look at patterns. And this is what they tell us when they look at Christians involved in policy issues in this country. There are three, generally speaking, there are three different kinds of patterns that you see. One group of Christians believes that state and church should be completely separate. Christians should never get involved in public policy issue. Setting them to the side, because if you don't believe you should be involved in public policy issue, then this issue of immigration isn't going to be that interesting to you. But the other two groups fall into these different categories. There's one group of Christians who believes very strongly that the church and the state should be the same thing. Okay, that if you're a Christian, you should think about what it means to be sinful, and you should try to get rid of those sins. And the church helps us understand what sins are, and once we understand what sins are, then we should work to use the government to help eliminate those sins. So you see a lot of non-denominational evangelicals fall into this group, and a lot of natural law Catholics fall into this group, and their emphasis is always the rule of law. God created the state should be obeyed, Christians have the obligation to obey the state, and so their entry into the immigration debate is going to be focused on the rule of law and the nation state. And the other group of Christians do not focus so much on rule of law. Instead, they focus on justice. And they say, if you look at the Old Testament, you see the prophets telling the kings over and over and over, you must act with justice to the people. You must care for the poor. You must care for those who are weak. And then if you look at Matthew 25 in the New Testament, Jesus tells the people that if you are a person who cares for the poor and the sick and the weak, you are a sheep, and Christ will acknowledge you and recognize you when Christ returns. But if you refuse to care for the poor, if you refuse to care for those who are sick, if you refuse to visit those who are in prison, you are a goat, and you will burn in eternal hell. That's pretty strong language from Jesus. So those are the two different groups. And this is what I think about them. I think it is not either or. All right? If you are a Christian and you take scripture seriously, you can see strength in both of the arguments, both in the argument that the rule of law is important and in the argument that justice is important. Okay? So a year and a half ago, there are a whole bunch of Christians who have gotten really sick of the debates about immigration, and they got together in Washington, D.C., and they the first group was an evangelical group, and they really enjoyed talking with each other, and then they invited all kinds of other Christians to come to the table. So Catholics and all kinds of mainline denominations came, and this huge group of Christians got together in Washington, D.C., and this is what, and they found common ground on this immigration issue. This is what they said. So this is that just this summer they put this statement out, the evangelical immigration table, but the word evangelical, you have to think of it as more broad than the way sometimes we think of evangelical. Our national immigration laws have created a moral, economic, and political crisis in America. Initiatives to remedy this crisis have led to polarization and name-calling in which opponents have misrepresented each other's positions as open borders and amnesty, on the one side, versus deportation of millions. Okay, it's a false choice. That's not what people are saying. This false choice has led to an unacceptable political stalemate at the federal level at a tragic human cost. So what do they say? They say there's 8 things that all Christians should agree on. And they all agreed. Conservatives, people on the left, people on the right, they all agreed on these 8 things. They want a bipartisan solution to immigration that respects the God-given dignity of every person, protects the unity of the immediate family, so you don't deport half and leave the other half there, respects the rule of law, it's a nod to one group, guarantees secure national borders, not just because of immigration, but also because of terrorism. It's important to have secure national borders, ensures fairness to taxpayers, and establishes a path toward legal status or citizenship for those who qualify and those who want to become permanent residents. So, there are 3 big public policy issues on the table, and I want to talk about them and apply these elements to these 3 issues. See if we can come to agreement in this room. One of them, DREAM Act legislation. You don't think so, huh? Okay. People are under the impression that Obama gave us a DREAM Act. Not true. The DREAM Act has been around for 12 years. It initially was suggested as a bipartisan, 2 senators got together, a bipartisan piece of legislation that it stands for development, relief, education for alien minors. All right? So it has never made it through Congress. There have been all kinds of different proposed DREAM Acts. It's never made it through Congress. These DREAM Acts all have something similar. Okay, the first thing that they do is they pick an age, like 19, 25, or 30, right? So people who are 19 or 25 or 30. And they say to them, we're going to put together this proposal. If you were brought into this country at the age of 16 or younger, okay, you can continue to try to qualify, 16 or younger, and you've been law-abiding, you have not broken the law, and you've finished high school and you've been accepted into college or the military, most of the plans provide for this, we will give you a path to residency, we'll give you legal residency and a path to citizenship. Has not gotten through Congress. Gets brought up every couple years, then kind of dies. Obama got sick of it. Obama passed a piece of executive order saying that that the executive branch would no longer prosecute people who qualified under this kind of a DREAM Act analysis. And the problem with an executive order is it lasts only as long as the president is there. The next president has the ability to get rid of it if he chooses. When Obama was reelected, we know that we're going to have this for another 4 years. This is the piece of legislation that I think has the biggest chance of being accepted in a bipartisan perspective soon, because Mark Rubio of Florida, who's a Republican, has also proposed something called STARS. And it's very similar to DREAM Act. The big argument's going to be about exactly what age do you start with. And Rubio wants to start with the age of 19. So the issue's going to be, if you want a DREAM Act starting with the age of people at 30, are you going to be willing to accept the age of 19 as your first step? The reason I think that this meets the test, those 8 elements for the bipartisan group of Christians, is that all of these people who qualify have not broken the law, okay? So the rule of law is strong. They have not broken the law. And then the second piece is that this gets at dignity of human beings. These kids who were brought in under the age of 16 and are up to 19, 25, 30, they have already demonstrated that they will obey the law. They have already demonstrated that they are focused and willing to contribute. And lots of studies that have been done demonstrate that these kids are, 10 years from now, going to be the kind of entrepreneurs that grow jobs in this country. Right? So that's the first one. Second one, I'm going to talk about guest worker program at the end. Second one, border fence. 2006, American Congress got together, passed a law saying we need a fence. That's what we need. That's how we're going to protect the borders. We need a fence. It's 1,950 miles long, the border. We have completed 650 miles of the fence. It's put up primarily in urban areas. So there's a little hole here. There are 4,000 breaches of the fence that exist every year, so the fence has to be monitored pretty regularly. So what are the arguments? Two arguments. When you're going to think about these Christian principles, one of the principles is enforcement of the border is important. So the question is a fence the way to go? If you ask Americans, what do you think about the fence? 70% say, fence is a good idea. That's how we should protect the border. Obama says, finish the fence. Mitt Romney said, finish the fence. When the Republican candidates got together and debated because they wanted to become the candidate for the Republican Party, Herman Cain said, let's make it an electronic fence. And Michelle Bachmann said, I think it should be a double. This picture of the double with the barbed wire, that's what she wants. Billions and billions of dollars. The only person who said, no fence, it's too expensive and it doesn't work, was who? Rick Perry. Rick Perry, the governor of Texas. You got to pay attention to those border states. He said, it's too expensive, it's not going to work. Costs $4 to $10 million per mile, and it doesn't work. It works a little bit right now in urban areas because people used to cross in urban areas and now they go to the rural areas and they die more quickly in the rural areas when they're crossing. But he said that what you need instead, and Homeland Security agrees with this and the Border Patrol officials agree with this, instead of the fence, you need boots and drones. You need boots on the ground and you need drones. So no fence. This is what the argument would be. Fence is a bad, even though both parties agree they want the fence, fence is a bad use of resources. This is a drone here. It's the same drone that goes over Pakistan, but they unarm it and send it over the border. The drones don't work very well right now. When you break down sort of the cost of what it costs to have the drone and how many crossers they catch, it's a lot of money per person. But everybody in Congress wants a drone. Everybody in Congress wants a drone for their own state. And so there's lots and lots and lots of enthusiasm about the drones. But so in terms of enforcement of the border, if you apply these elements, probably you don't want a fence, but instead boots. Now, the Arizona law. Arizona passed this really strict law a few years ago. It was tested by the Supreme Court. Most of it failed. The two pieces of it that survived are E-Verify and a criminal law procedure. So let me talk about each of them. E-Verify is an electronic verification process by which employers test whether or not the person they're going to hire is in the United States legally. It has so many bugs in it. 20% of the people who are identified as not being allowed to be in the United States legally are actually allowed to be working in the United States. So right now it's a voluntary program because it doesn't work very well. State of Arizona said we are going to require all of our employers to participate in E-Verify. And the Supreme Court said that's okay, you can do that if you want to. Okay, so it exists right now. What's interesting about this chart is that you look at Illinois. Illinois, which remember has exactly the same number of undocumented workers as Arizona, Illinois said, E-Verify is so bad, we're passing legislation telling our employers they should not use it. Even though it's voluntary, you should not use it. And then New York says, we don't even want to touch it. Our state has pending legislation on using E-Verify. So E-Verify hurts not necessarily the undocumented worker. It hurts citizens of Hispanic descent because those are the people who are being identified as not allowed to be in the country when actually they are citizens or they have residence. And you have the exact same problem with the criminal law. The criminal law in Arizona says that police officers, if they have reason to believe that a person is an undocumented resident, they need to verify that, they need to take the person into custody and verify their status. Supreme Court has said this looks a little dicey. We don't know how it's going to play out. But at the moment, there is no evidence that it's going to be used in a racist way. Again, the people you're concerned about with this one is not necessarily the undocumented worker, but it is the worker who is of Hispanic descent, who does not have to carry their papers around. You know, none of us have to carry our papers around, but they are citizens, and they don't happen to have a way to prove it when they're in the car, all right? So my argument would be, as a Christian concerned about these issues, is that we need to get documentation on whether or not they're being used in a racist way. So over the course of the next 2 years, we're going to see three things discussed. One, we have to develop data on racism in law enforcement policy. Is there racism in the way that our policies are carried out? The last one, prosecutorial discretion, I would argue based on those eight elements that Christian perspective agreed on, our prosecutorial emphasis should be on the trafficking of drugs and human beings, unwilling trafficking of human beings, and then a guest worker program. This is the next big piece of legislation that's going to come through that people on both sides of the aisle are talking about, and it is controversial. It's controversial because a lot of people on the right don't like it, and a lot of people on the left don't like it. People on the left don't like a guest worker program because they say it creates a two-tiered residency, and we abuse workers, and that's not fair. People on the right say it increases immigration, a guest because they will overstay a visa or overstay their documentation. I would say it is the best next step. It's the next step. If you're on the left, it's the best next step because the only way to get rights is to be here legally. It's very hard to argue for rights if you're here always worried that you're going to be deported. And for people on the left, there really is not that much evidence that a guest worker program in other nations increases illegal immigration. There are ways to control that with border enforcement. So that's where the students and I are at this point, and I would welcome questions from you. There is another mic somewhere. Just speak very loudly if you have a question. We've got about 10, 12 minutes for questions or comments. Yes.
Can you wait up a second, please? Sorry.
My question was about Rubio's Act. Did you say it was called the STARS Act?
Yeah.
I believe that it doesn't actually provide a path to citizenship, and so that's a pretty big difference between the DREAM Act. And would you support the STARS Act as, okay, well, it is a compromise, and although it's a compromise on a large portion of it, it's still worthwhile, or that's too far?
Yeah, this is what I would say. Okay, you're right. Some of the DREAM Act legislation and the STARS Act legislation provides a path to residency, legal residency, but not to citizenship. Okay, I think that if you talk to undocumented workers, legal residence is a good thing. Okay, citizenship is the best thing, but legal residence is a good thing, and it gives you the first step. So I would say whatever legislation comes through, if you're a Democrat, support the Republican legislation. If you're a Republican, support the Democrat legislation. Don't try to hold out for something perfect because it is not going to come. We've had decades and decades, and the perfect piece doesn't come. That's what I would say. Okay. Someone else? Oh, seriously, no other comments. Yep, way in the back. Yeah, God-given dignity, unity of the immediate family, respects the rule of law, secure national borders, fairness to taxpayers, path toward status or citizenship. And not everybody at the table agreed on all eight, but everybody at the table agreed that this compromise was a good compromise, okay? Because there are people at the table who were saying, look, I just don't think that secure national borders beyond terrorism is important. I think that we should have open borders, okay? But they accepted the compromise. And this might not seem like a big deal to you, but it's a really big deal because most Christians sort of go with what their political party says. And this required Christians on both sides of the aisle to step away from their political party and to build some kind of a unified approach. Yes. Where's that? She is.
My son got his master's degree from UCLA in engineering, and he was the only U.S. citizen. The other students that received at taxpayer expense their PhDs all wanted to stay in this country, and they were not allowed. Could you talk about that type of immigration reform?
Yeah. Another area where after the last election, Republicans saw that they need to pay attention to particularly the Hispanic vote. And so it has revived a lot of discussion about where we can go next. And one of the things that both sides agree on, and they've even made some inroads in the last year of Obama's, that this is one of the few things where they had bipartisan legislation, was to increase the number of visas, long-term visas, given to people who had finished education programs. So that number is increasing every year. Now, the question is that even fair to increase that number because the degrees are at taxpayer expense? Many of the degrees are not at taxpayer expense. They are paid for by the country that sent the student. But some of them are at taxpayer expense. The question then is, do we have citizens who could fill those jobs? And the arguments of both the Democrats and the Republicans is that our math and science tunnels of students coming through are not sufficient to fill the need. And that's why we have to open the doors and let them stay longer, because they will create jobs for American citizens.
So you talked about how if there weren't laborers that were non-U.S. citizens, the fruit would rot, or whatever the agricultural product. What does it take for all the people who do come from another country to get here to harvest our crops? What does it take for them to get here? Do they usually have legal residency, or?
But you mean to be the people who work those crops?
Yes. Yeah.
Most of them at this point are people that have overstayed a visa or have come across the border illegally and have, there are patterns of migration for different crops at different times across the whole United States, in the North and in the South. And it is law enforcement turns their face in a number of situations, lets the crop, as long as the law is being obeyed and people aren't harming each other, lets the crops be harvested, and then they move to another. There's just this huge population and community of people that serve the rest of us in this way. It is more and more dangerous for them to cross the border to come and do this. And it is hard. It's hard for me to even say that that's a good solution, to open the door and to give legal residency and a guest worker program, because I am offended by the idea that we pay a tiny bit of money and we do not educate these children, and these children are exposed to pesticides that I would not expose my child to. I mean, there is a bigger issue underneath that than just may the workers do the work. And that is, how do we handle agricultural work in general? Or do we do that in a just way? And I would say we do not.
Here. If we ever passed laws that would make it easier for immigrants to come to America, would that not cause human trafficking to become more, you know, have more human trafficking in the United States? And if so, if it caused that, how would we battle that?
Well, I think it's a good question. Human trafficking is a very different animal than people crossing a border with their own family to try to make a living. Okay, human trafficking is an illegal way in which people are sometimes drugged, sometimes sold by their parents. To catch people who are illegally trafficking children is a completely different process than catching people who are crossing a border illegally. So since they're two different things, I think you can achieve opening the numbers that come in legally and still crack down on trafficking.
So I have a question. What would you say to policies which punish those business owners who do hire the illegal immigrants? Do you think that those policies would be helpful, or do you think that they would just lead to more kind of fraud and things like that?
Okay, and this is where my friends who are in the room are not going to like my answer, but I'm just going to say it anyway, okay? I believe in the law. I believe in the rule of law firmly. I think that our laws should be just, but I think our laws should be kept. And businesses, so if at the same time we are cutting down on human trafficking and we have a program that allows people to come in to do the jobs that they want to do and that we need done, I think if we have that, then we should really crack down on the businesses that violate the law, especially because a lot of businesses violate the law in a way that benefits the middle and upper class in the United States at the expense of others. And that just, I find, very unjust at a deep level.
I had a question that's kind of based on how to balance the responsibility of the church to respect the rule of law,
mm-hmm.
And at the same time to care for the foreigner.
Yep.
And in a little study this summer, in my internship, I found out that the word ger, I don't know if I pronounce it right, but G-E-R, the word for foreigner in Hebrew, appears in the Bible 92 times.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of the narrative of the Israelites being in Egypt and then coming out and kind of that story and God giving them the charge to take care of the foreigner should really be a model for us, you know, to always look towards the marginalized.
Yeah.
And yet that has kind of been removed from, you know, like biblical teaching around this.
Right. There's an argument between and among Christians on what that word means. And does the word for foreigner in Hebrew mean the same as sojourner? Does it mean the same as an undocumented resident? Were those sojourners the same as the sojourners today? Right. And I'm not a Hebrew scholar. I don't know. And again, I am sure, Alexander, my answer will disappoint you, because churches, there are sanctuary cities that have declared themselves to be to be cities in which they will not accommodate or go along with law enforcement because they want to be kind to the foreigner. And I admire that in the same way that I admire the civil unrest of the 1960s and the civil unrest of the civil rights movement. Okay, but I am, before I'm a faculty member, I am a lawyer, I'm a Christian lawyer, I believe in the rule of law, and I think the law should be changed so that we are just to the foreigner.
And so then the church should...
The church, okay, I'm not a pastor, right? I admire churches. I admire churches that do this. I cannot do it myself. I cannot join in on a flagrant violation of the law when we have not ended the possibility of having a more just law. I'm not going to criticize those who do. I think there's all kinds of different Christians with all kinds of different feelings about their responsibility and calling. It is just, as your pre-law advisor, I can't go there. All right, so it's after 8. Thank you so much for coming. Really appreciate it.